It's Saturday, July 7th, 7707 on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, we discuss the weekend news, and then we take your calls during the second half of the show. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I am your host, Sean Cleveland. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, as you can tell, Lyle is out. He is, in fact, on a much-needed vacation out of state, and hopefully he is having a good time.
He said he was in his email.
Today, I am joined in the air room with Miles Elam. And
good morning.
And Drew.
Hey, good morning, Sean.
And as you can tell, I'm not used to doing this, so we'll see what we can do here. JD is on board, and we have Alex on the air as well. I believe, Alex, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
So the numbers here are 476-2800 and toll-free 1-800-655-5877. We'll be taking calls today, but not till the second half of the show. And you can also send us an email at geekspeak.org and just click on Contact Us. GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, call 423-2447. So today on GeekSpeak, we're going to talk about the news. I guess I'll officially welcome everybody. We got Miles Elam, our Slacker geek and student.
Good morning.
We have Drew Meyer, product manager at Network Appliance.
All right. Good morning.
Alex Fleas, application security analyst for Fidelity National Financial. Alex, you there?
Yep.
Great. We have Rick answering phones. So if you do call in, say, hey, Rick, get me on the air. Let's talk a little about news.
All right.
Drew, let's start with you.
Well, there's an interesting trend that Symantec's weblog reported about scammers, people who are buying and selling credit card numbers. So when they buy your credit card, they need to make sure that when they sell it, that they actually purchase something that was useful. So if somebody gets a hold of your credit card, they want to test it out. Well, in the old days, people would just ding you for a penny or something, see if the account actually worked. But it looks like recently, these good-hearted internet scammers are actually making donations to charities in order to test out that credit card's viability. So I guess the message here is rest assured that if your card does get stolen, you're going to end up contributing to something valuable. How about that, you guys?
Wow.
Amazing. Bank monitors are kind of less likely to pick up on donations to charities. Legitimate donations aren't usually daily transactions for anyone with their credit card, so it's kind of hard. It's a legitimate-looking, non-run-of-the-mill sort of a charge, and it's probably likely that we'll see this trend grow, according to the blogger. But at least the stolen money is going to a good cause.
No kidding. That's really hard to believe.
The question is, I mean, if does the charity get to keep the money if the banks have to, I mean, or do the banks just eat the charge?
I suppose it depends on the amount, too. I imagine the credit card's insured for a certain amount, and you're not responsible for it, and they may not be responsible. The entry doesn't cover that. It's a good question.
So, Alex, what do you got for us this morning?
Oh, let's go with some entertainment news. It seems our Mac guy is, the guy who plays the Mac on the Apple commercials. He's actually going to be in Die Hard, or the next Die Hard movie, and he plays our little computer hacker. Apparently, he really doesn't know a whole lot about computers.
That's Justin Long, right?
Yeah, Justin Long.
Where could we see this guy?
What was that?
Where can we see this guy? Are the Apple commercials on Apple's website?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. You can see them on the Apple commercials, the website. Just turn on your TV and watch it for a while. I'm sure one of them will pop up. Well, maybe not anymore, but they used to be all over the place.
It's amazing just the sheer number of those ads that Apple created. I went to Apple.com and watched most all of them, and I just couldn't believe how many there were I hadn't seen. And they're very clever.
Yeah, well, I mean, and then, of course, he's not the super smart computer hacker guy that he plays in Die Hard, but I don't think that's super surprising. I mean,
wait, are you saying that Morgan Freeman was not the president at one time, and that that actors aren't always what they actually are, what they appear on the screen?
Yeah, I know. Just think about The Matrix. Oh dear God.
It must be difficult for him, though. I mean, he's created this persona of being, you know, an enthusiast, a hacker, you know, a guy in the know, and he really doesn't know. I bet people approach him all the time and want to talk about tech.
You know, given how that's probably helped his career so much, I can't have all that much pity for him.
It would be a little interesting to do a little research on your character and find out more about Macintosh. Let's see how he does.
So, he probably has a Mac, I'm guessing, right? Apple would probably make sure he had a Mac.
Good question. No, he doesn't send them in the Die Hard movies, though. Apparently those are all PCs.
Now, you said you had some more entertainment news.
Sure. Let's see. On TVSquad.com, we have a reviewer decided to kind of do a 7 coolest geeks on television, which I thought was kind of amusing and might be worth listing off. So I'll start from the bottom and work my way up on this, if I can find the bottom. All right, so number 7, we have Patton Oswalt. He's from The King of Queens. Number 6 is Bill Hader from Saturday Night Live.
Do you remember what he played?
Saturday Night Live?
Yeah.
I don't remember the actual names of the characters, but I certainly remember him. Let's see. Oh, actually, no, I do know one that he played that was really great. The Italian Reviewer. That was always pretty funny.
Okay.
Couldn't speak a word of real English. We've got the comic book guy from The Simpsons.
Nice.
He's definitely a geek worth noting. Number 4 is Matt Stone and Trey Parker. Yeah, if you don't know who they are, South Park. I mean, you got to know who that is.
They certainly look geeky. They must be.
Number 3, we've got Seth Green from Family Guy. I guess he was in Family Guy, played the Robot Chicken.
Yeah, you know, Robot Chicken on Adult Swim.
Yeah, brilliant.
It's pretty funny. And he just did a Star Wars special. With George Lucas was involved. It was a half-hour run sketch comedy based on Star Wars. I laughed pretty hard on some of those.
Now I'm noticing that you're delving into cartoon characters. You're not even delving into someone, you know, or playing a full character. I guess a cartoon character is just as much a character as a real-life character.
There's still pretend characters on the show.
keep going with the list.
It's a good point.
And we got number 2 is Conan O'Brien. And
as a geek?
As a geek, apparently. I don't know why this person rated him as a geek, but I guess he's a bit geeky.
Well, maybe his writers have some very geeky references that they make him say.
And the number 1 I have to say I do agree with, it's Adam and Jamie from the Mythbusters.
Yeah. Man,
those guys are real geeks.
Those guys are
hardcore geeks.
Deserving of the title.
Yeah, you can take those guys seriously, but the rest has to do with comedy and...
Yeah,
cartoons. Yeah.
I do have to admit, I take issue with this. I can think of a lot of geeks that I would prefer off of TV and movies and the like. For example, David Krumholtz from the TV show Numbers.
I don't know.
Total geek and someone who actually tried to be more like a realistic geek as opposed to a caricature.
Mm-hmm.
Characters like that are ones where I think like, oh, hey, there's a great geek.
Yeah. I'm blanking.
I mean, more so than the comic book guy on The Simpsons.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, Miles, you can go to TVSquad.com and go complain about this list.
Oh, I plan to.
All right.
All right, Miles, what do you got for us?
There's a scary storm, as being dubbed by NASA, on Mars that could doom the rovers. These rovers that have been going for years now, where they were only planned originally for a 3-month trip or a 90-day trip. They're running into a problem where a storm has been kicked up on Mars. Mars has very light very light dust over much of the planet. And so any little bit of wind is going to kick that dust up in the air, obscuring the light. All the rovers are running on solar power panels. Therefore, reducing the amount of light is going to cause a problem. In addition to that, all the dust is raising the temperature in the upper atmosphere, making that storm more serious, much as when we talk about Hurricane Katrina, how the hurricane was getting more and more mild over time, but as it passed over the Gulf of Mexico and hit that warmer water, it generate at a higher intensity. Same thing here, although with regard to Mars, you're talking about going from sub-Antarctic to Antarctic temperatures. But this is, once again, up into the atmosphere. On the surface, it's actually making it colder, which is making things worse. Not only are you reducing the amount of light that's going to these solar panels, but you're reducing the temperature and going to cause problems with the electronics. In other words, it has to keep the they have to keep the electronics working on the rovers in order to keep everything running, to keep the battery from completely just freezing in place, to actually keep it moving, or rather keep the reaction going, which is going to generate some heat. Also running electricity through the electronics, running experiments, or just running different parts of the rover.
Did they say just how cold it's going to get?
Did they mention a specific temperature? All I got was that it was sub-Antarctic. They don't know for sure.
So the batteries are not going to be able to be recharged, and they're going to drain faster because it's cold?
Well, they're worried. One, it's similar to what people will experience in the northern portions of this country, northeastern, where if it gets cold enough, the battery dies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where it can't hold any charge.
If you have problems with the solar cells, then it's certainly not going to get enough energy to replenish those batteries.
Right. But in addition to that, the solder points on the circuit boards, if it gets too cold, the solder is going to contract because it's so cold and might crack, in which case you're going to lose the valuable chips that you have on there. Something's going to break.
Now, the chips themselves are most likely designed to withstand the cold.
Yeah, I'm kind
of curious, extent.
To a certain extent.
And they're planning on always having something running so that it can... You can have some.
I know in the embedded space, having worked at Transmeta, chips need to be able to take somewhere down to negative 40 C. It's kind of what they're designed to. But yeah, they can't. There is a point at which they will crack.
Now, I mean, you got to wonder though, if these rovers go through the whole Mars winter, I mean, they do kind of shut down and go into a kind of a reserve state. Couldn't they just do something similar for this storm?
That's what they were looking for. Then again, with regard to the winter, they were able to put it into a position so that when the light was coming back to them, it would be ready and available. And they weren't sure that it would work. If you recall, the first time they tried this, they weren't sure that it actually would work. This storm, however, rather previously it's weathered storms, but those storms had a few weeks of ramp-up time so they could get prepared for it, hunker down. This storm, according to many NASA officials, came out of nowhere. They didn't have time to prepare for it. So they've been, any communications they can get to it, they've been trying to shut things down as best they can.
I'd love to hear the story behind all this because, you know, they weren't expecting these rovers to continue. And 3.5 years later, here they are. They must
Actually, aren't we running on 4 years?
Are we running on four? So they must have had, their budgets fixed so that taking that into account. And here they are now with their both rovers still running. Teams need to be on hand to control them. There's data still coming in, keeping people busy. I mean, wow. It's great news, but then for the finance department, I'm sure they're pulling their hair out.
Now, I mean, if they make it through this storm, though, they're just sitting strong and just keep on chugging. I mean,
so there's, you know, Apple iPhone. We've talked about this last week. Came out, but there's a new thorn in Apple's side. Turns out that the battery in the iPhone. If it needs to be replaced, at some point it probably will be, it just doesn't pop out like most other smartphones. It's actually soldered in place, and it's not easy to get to. It's not something that you can replace, and it's going to cost you, well, $79 for the battery and $6.95 for shipping to Apple because they got to do the work. And they say it's going to take 3 business days, not including the days for shipping. So they've got a program in place to take care of this. From what I'm reading, all data on the iPhone will be erased when you send it off. So it's probably they suggest that you back it up before you do that.
Well, that's one of the ideas behind it, is that it syncs up with your contacts.
Yeah,
it syncs up with iTunes.
It should be backed
and
up.
And all your music is on your main system.
And if you know, you're going to be out without a phone for possibly a week, right? So they've got another program in place where Apple will rent you an iPhone for $29 while your device is being serviced.
And then you just take out your SIM card and put it into the new iPhone, I'm assuming?
I don't think iPhones use SIM cards.
No, you probably just resync it back to your computer.
No, right. To be able to talk on the phone identity, network, huh? You would need a SIM card.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I thought there was something about the SIM card that prevented it from being usable on other networks. But then I heard a story that people are trying to unlock the iPhone to make it usable on other networks within the time frame where they can still cancel their AT&T service.
You know, this is one thing that I find disturbing about the iPhone is that, and one, you've got this whole battery issue, which is the same problem as they have with the iPods. People are always complaining about batteries running out, and it's costing, you know, a lot of money to replace the batteries. They still haven't fixed the problem in the iPhone. How much does that iPhone cost?
Yeah, it's
$600.
It's $500 for the low-end version, $600 for the high-end.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of money to not have better solutions, and especially soldering the battery in. That's just ridiculous. It ought to be easily replaceable so people can get parts.
But then again, isn't the iPhone much like many of the iPods? Many of the iPods, you can't change the battery in them.
Exactly.
You can plug them in and charge them.
You think they would have learned their lesson from all that, and how many of their consumers actually complained about that.
And $79. $79 for a battery. That's like the price of a laptop battery.
Yeah, but how long do you keep a phone? I mean, folks who are buying the iPhone are early adopters, and early adopters in general aren't keeping their phone for that long, not as long as most folks. You're keeping it, what, for the term, the agreement that you have for 2 years?
People, you know, for most like phones, I would say that's totally true, but I normally don't spend $600 on a phone. So if I were to actually buy the phone, I'd really expect it to last longer than the normal couple of years.
And what does that mean about disposing of the battery? Are we just supposed to throw the phone in the landfill? Typically, you can take out a battery and recycle it.
Well, Apple will take out the battery.
And Alex,
if
you're talking about
$6 to send it home,
when you're talking about the phone not lasting, this is not a case where the phone suddenly becomes junk. Yes, you have a couple of days where you have to have the battery replaced, but this is not completely trashing it.
No, I understand, yeah, but it's still just more cost that they're, you know, from a lessons learned that where they've had complaints from their consumers with the iPods, they're making the same choices. I don't want to say mistakes because I somehow think this was actually thought through. You know, in terms of watching their revenue lines over time.
You know, I'd love to hear from a listener who has an iPhone just to get their feedback. And I've got a few questions for them, too. If you're listening, call 476-2800 or 1-800-655-5877. And we'll be taking calls halfway into the show. I'll give the numbers again at that point. But if you got an iPhone, please consider calling us. We'd love to pick your brain. Anybody else got some news?
Sure.
Miles, Go for it.
Open document format, something I've talked about in the past. This is a rival format to Microsoft's Word documents, Excel, PowerPoint. Sun has sponsored a plugin for Microsoft Office 2000, Microsoft XP in 2003. And what this plugin does is allows, while you're in Word, to be able to import and export, in other words, save and load Word documents, Excel, and PowerPoint. The reason why I bring this up and the reason why I want folks to take a look at using it is something that I've come across myself recently, which is dusting off my resume. Resumes in a Word document format. I just got a new Macintosh, so I don't have really much software on it as it stands. And one of the things I didn't have was a copy of Word or a legal copy of it. I had one of the trial copies, which has a watermark on the back that says this is a trial copy, and it's not something you want to have on your resume when you print it out and send it to someone.
Right.
So I was finding, wait a second, this is something that I hadn't thought about in a couple of years, my resume. But it's something that I still find important because it's a lot easier to add your most recent thing to an existing resume, your most recent job to an existing resume, than to make one from scratch. And yet I didn't have Word. I would have to go out and buy a couple $100 just to access documents that I already wrote. And that's why I think of open document format as being so important. It's a format that has an open specification, and worst comes to worst, you can open it up and just look at the text. It's a text-based format rather than a binary format like Word. But in addition to that, it's something that is being pushed for multiple word processing programs. So whether you use OpenOffice or StarOffice or Microsoft Office, you can have the same format and have that available no matter what program you migrate to in the future. So that's something that I do highly recommend. And you can find that on Sun's site at www.sun.com. And I'll be putting the link up on the show page later on today.
So how do we, as consumers or users, how do we help this standard to become adopted?
By using it. Quite simply, by using that format. If you use that format, it makes an incentive for other people to be able to read it. And luckily, this plugin is free. It requires a plug-in to install.
The plug-in goes into Office for Word,
right.
Or
installs onto Office so that you have a new menu item.
And then you save documents in that format?
Yep.
And then once you saved it in that format, somebody without Office can open it in their browser? Or how does that work?
No, someone can open it up with no matter what word processing application they're using.
I see.
And it is a format that is gaining more traction. So not only can you use it in such suites as OpenOffice or StarOffice, but more and more you're going to be seeing word processing suites, especially if they want to compete with Microsoft Office, using it as leverage point in order to be able to be used in the first place.
But Office depends on having that plugin installed in order to be compatible with the rest of them. Right.
However, the plugin is free.
Yeah.
So it doesn't require any type of commitment on the user's part.
Yeah, it's kind of a
chicken and egg thing, though. Unless you're convinced that everyone's going to move to this standard, why bother?
When you say everyone moves to the standard, you mean the people using it or the software that can support it?
Well, the users need to if most of us are Word users, so if we install it then and start using it, then we begin to establish a precedent for the format.
But
if we don't,
that,
if we just continue status quo, there's no traction.
Except for the fact that the status quo, you talk about the existing standard or de facto standard, let's say, for example, Word.
Right.
That is not a standard. One, you can't
find
out.
It is in terms of
it.
Users. I mean, the standard
is established
by feet.
On the contrary, it isn't. If you have Office 2007, then you transmit a document, which you've always done in Word, and you pass it to someone who has Office 2003, they can't read it.
No, that's not correct.
Yeah, that's not correct.
That's if you specifically save it in a new format.
You can open it as a Word 2003 format document.
Yeah. I do it all the time. That's not a big deal.
Really?
You know what I'd like to know, though, is what...
Because this wasn't the case in the past. If you had, like, Office 95 to Office 97...
No, it works just fine.
It's backward compatible. It's built in.
No, you can save it in a format that they can read. You could save it to Office 2003. But if you save it as a normal Word document, it's going to be Word 2007. Unless you specifically think about it, in which case you are no better off than if you specifically think about
specifically,
open document format.
I don't remember specifically saving a new document that I created... And opening it, I haven't had that. I'm not running into that problem where I could not open a document yet.
I guess my
point. Well, if you're always using the latest version, I think the problem is if you're using the latest version and save it and email it off to some friend that's still running on Office.
No, I'm using computers with a mix of both, and I haven't run into that problem yet. But you know, I'll try and come up with that scenario, and we can talk about it next week. I'd like to see if I can make that happen.
I know it's definitely the case with Office 2003 and Office 2097.
What I
want to
know is. What happens if somebody with this this plugin creates an open off? It's called
an open document format.
An open document format. Or they save that in that format and they send it off to somebody with Word that doesn't have that plugin and they try and open that document? What happens?
Then they can't open it.
Right.
They have to install the plugin.
And do they know where to get the plugin? Are they told that you can't open it because this is a specific format? And you need this plugin.
Or you mean does by double clicking on the screen?
Yeah.
No.
Or does Word just look at it and say, "I don't know what this is"?
Well, most people don't open up Word and then say file open. Most people just double click on the icon that's there. So you're right.
There's it's not attached to Word.
I like the idea.
It means we have to give instructions into the email.
I'm not going to hold my breath.
Yeah. All right, let's move on. We are going to take calls here momentarily after a few messages. GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Cruise.io, providing local internet services, including DSL, computer care, classes, and website builders. Information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. You're listening to GeekSpeak. We are now taking your calls with questions and comments on technology. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can get those numbers at KUSP.org, or you can send us an email, visit geekspeak.org, and click on Contact Us, and we'll be monitoring email. You're invited to a day of family fun at Jelly Beans, 2555 Soquel Drive, Santa Cruz, today from noon to 4 p.m. There'll be face painting, a music circle, ice cream social, a clown, and much more. Admission is free. Proceeds will benefit the Gomes children who are losing their mom to cancer. Come sing, play, and celebrate family at Jelly Beans today, July 7th from noon to 4. For more information, contact Helen at 831-334-9031. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Sean Cleveland. In the air room are with me are Miles Elam and Drew Meyer. And on the phone is Alex Slias. And hopefully Alex will be able to stay on with us as we take your calls. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, Notary Republic, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. So please give us a call. We can pretty much answer any of your questions today, I think. Yeah, we've pretty much got everything covered here.
And we'll give it a shot. We've got another news story on hot fuel if we're waiting for calls to come
in. Yeah, yeah.
Alex just reminded me. I had to set it open here.
I heard about this hot fuel issue. This is pretty crazy.
You drive a hybrid, so I guess it's less of a concern. You're consuming fewer calories through gasoline.
So what is the hot fuel issue?
The hot fuel issue is that when gasoline is dispensed at a high temperature, like if the day is warm, then you actually get less gasoline because it expands in the tank. It expands during the pumping process. So you get less energy of a gallon of fuel of that when it's hot than when you get it from a cold one or a more densely liquefied form. In fact, and so you think, well, big deal. So I lose a few grams of energy or a few joules, whatever you want to measure it by. There's been a subcommittee from the House of Representatives that estimates that this summer we're going to lose over $1.5 billion in terms of hot fuel.
Wait, consumers.
Consumers will pay a $1.5 billion premium for hot fuel this summer alone. So when you think about those kinds of numbers, that's a lot of extra cash going to oil companies.
Just because of the temperature that the price that the gas is sold at is not what the temperature you pump it at.
Hold on. Would this go to oil companies or would this go to gas stations?
Well, I don't know how the distribution chain works, but it gets paid by the consumer at the pump. And if I buy a gallon of gas here in Santa Cruz, and if I buy a gallon of gas in San Diego and it's warmer in San Diego, then I may get less energy for the same price as I did up here in Santa Cruz. That's the crux of the argument. Industry and government standards say that a gallon of gas at 60 degrees measures 231 cubic inches. And so you buy 231 cubic inches of gas every time you buy a gallon, regardless of its temperature. When gas expands in the heat, the amount of energy per gallon declines. With me on the argument here so far?
No kidding. Why can't the pumps just do the math for you?
That's exactly the proposed solution. The pumps should have a temperature sensor and gauge the dispensing based on the temperature of the fuel when it's dispensed.
So now you mentioned that X billion dollars, that's going to affect everybody now. But I mean, down to the individual, have you read, in terms of what it's actually caused, what's the difference to us on a more realistic scale?
That's a good question. It's hard to say, but the article here discusses a difference for consumers in the actual cost between 3 and 9 cents a gallon at the pump. So, if you're in Santa Cruz, you pay $1, and in San Diego, you pay $1.09. That's basically the difference.
All right, so it's basically $1.50 to $2 per tank difference.
We need some outrage here.
My opinion on this. The beer question is why are we using gasoline in the first place? But that's a whole different geek speak, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's been handled on a whole different geek speak.
Yeah, consumers' attorneys say that in Canada, where gas temperatures are generally colder, the advantage shifts to the consumer. That adjustment equipment already has been installed at the gas pumps. A Chicago attorney says that the oil industry wants it both ways. They want to push the temperature adjustment in Canada where it's in their favor when it's colder, and in the United States when it's warmer, they don't want this standard at all. So go figure.
They've got the lobbyists, right? We got a call on line one from Renato from Santa Cruz. Audio recording on a PC. Is that your question, Renato?
Yes, it is.
What exactly do you need to know?
Okay, I would like to find out... Most people use an interface, a USB connection or FireWire or with a PCI sound card installed, whatever. I was wondering if going directly into the line-in of the sound card through an amplifier or some kind of multi-effect would be much different, quality recording.
Yeah,
is anybody that can answer the question?
I think USB 2 has the bandwidth to handle audio just fine, and you'll find high-end recording equipment that offers USB 2 connectivity.
You didn't get my question,
but
right.
You just want to record audio from your machine.
No, but I'm asking if I do not use a USB interface or a FireWire, but I go straight into the lining. Input of the sound card.
You should be able to do that just fine.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. What is the difference in quality for recording instead of using an interface USB interface or FireWire interface.
The reason why you'd use USB or FireWire is that you have basically your sound card is external to your machine. That USB device is itself a sound card. So if you have a sound card within your laptop and you connect it blind in, you're doing fundamentally the same thing, and you shouldn't see any quality difference. What the quality difference would be is the quality of the sound card itself rather than the mechanism
for getting it. Right, so why most people use an interface, a USB interface?
Because they may not have an easy-to-use or easy-to-access cabling within their machine, or their machine may have a lower quality sound card than the USB device that they're connecting up.
I see. So,
with a notebook,
for example,
that's the issue. It's the quality of the audio in the notebook. Especially with the notebook,
or the audio processor,
audio processor is just not as good a quality. It doesn't have 24-bit capability, whereas the external USB devices do.
Well, not all of them, but some. I mean, you can buy one that is a higher quality than a low quality one on a laptop.
Yeah.
I see. Okay, for example, if I have like one of those sound cards that are attached to the motherboard, not necessarily low quality sound cards, right?
The issue is, particularly to Sean's point, with the notebook, the sound card you buy is the sound card you're going to have forever. So if you have a 2 or 3 year old notebook and you want better sound quality, you may want to use an external device that has a sound card.
Well, I'm not necessarily talking about a notebook, but I use a desk PC.
Right. So in a desktop, you have a choice. You can use the sound card that came in the external device, or you could upgrade the sound card in the machine in the PCI slot. And then if you purchase a better one.
Well, he was also talking about the one that's on the motherboard. Like, how is the quality on that? And that will vary by the manufacturer of the motherboard. Some motherboards have very high quality audio, and other ones are barely adequate.
And how do I find out? If I don't know when if I didn't pay attention when I bought the PC, well, how do I find out if it's quality?
Connect it up to the motherboard and record something. See if you like the quality. If you think it's not good enough,
that's one way to do it. Yeah. Another way to do it is to pull the side off your computer. On the motherboard will be written the model number. Do a Google on that model number and then look to see what audio you have.
Usually, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Usually, I was wondering maybe with the Pentium 3, Pentium 4 computer.
I can tell you Pentium 2 or Pentium 3 computer, if you have integrated motherboard audio, it's going to be what's called AC97, which is really cheap audio, and it's just not that good.
If it's integrated. Otherwise,
It's only the newer motherboards in the past year and a half or so that have started including high-definition audio built into the motherboards.
But usually the most laptops nowadays have a good...
Newer laptops have pretty good audio.
Go to bellarc.com, B-E-L...
Say it again?
Bellarc, B-E-L-A-R-C.com. Download their...
Bellarc?
Bellarc. They have a free tool called Bellarc Advisor that will tell you information about your system, your motherboard, your sound card chips, etc.
Oh, great. Okay, I'll do that.
And then you can take that chip information and, like Sean suggested, either look up the motherboard specifications or look up the sound chip specifications. If there's an integrated one, it'll tell you that. And then you'll get ideas on what the quality is, and you can compare that if you want to upgrade or keep it.
Great.
But you know, you really do need to just try it for yourself and see if you like the quality, like Miles suggests.
I try for myself. That's the thing. I'm recording. I've been recording, and my recording sounds great. But I don't use an interface like many other...
Use what they use. Whatever sounds best for you works.
I just go straight into the line-in outlet of the input of the sound card, and it works fine with me. So I was wondering, I don't hear any difference.
Okay, thanks for the call, Renato.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, bye.
Bye.
Let's go to line two and take Larry from Atlanta, Georgia. Wow.
Hi, guys. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
Good morning, Larry. Are you listening to us? You must be listening to us on the internet.
Yes, I am. And in fact, I will tell you, my friend. I actually listen to your show every week because you guys have. As a matter of fact, I actually learn a lot from your show, and I thank you so much for that.
That's great. Thank you for listening.
Guys need some help a little bit. What I have is a very very small business, one person myself, is a service business, and what I do basically is provide what I call a landlord relief service. What I like to do as a way of getting more business is have a web page. Now I will tell you, I'm kind of intimidated by that. However, I read about these different sites, maybe like such as MSN, you know, Windows Live or Yahoo or Earthlink, for example, that have sites which allow you to use a template.
That's good. So you want to know what are the best sites for to just take a template, a web-based design, and then modify it for your own uses. That's open source and free.
Yes. In addition to, I'd like to ask you what effect can I do? As a small business person, in order to promote my webpage and in order to get more business.
So I got a quick question for you here. What's wrong with the built-in templates in the Microsoft tool like Word or Front Page, which they provide? Other than that, they're not particularly powerful or capable, but
actually, a lot of the online shops, like say Yahoo Shops or something similar to that, will provide some choices for how you want the site. They will get you up and running. I don't know of any specifically. If there's any listener that has an idea of something, any suggestions, something that they've gone through, any procedure that they like, or any company that they like that provides this, please send us an email. We'd love to hear about it.
You know what, Larry? I think you need to send us an email.
So we can do some more research.
The problem is Lyle's not here, who's our expert on this sort of thing, and Dee Dee, our geek in, I think she's in Idaho.
Iowa. Ohio.
Ohio.
Iowa. I don't know.
So she is also really knowledgeable on these types of template software that you can download use. And I think they could help you on email best.
I need to ask you your exact email address, please.
I just go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. And when you send an email there, it goes to all the geeks.
Or when you fill out the form there.
Yeah.
Check with your ISP. They probably have some tools built into your subscription.
Oh. Thank you, Larry. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Rick also points out that our sponsor, Cruise.io, has something called Site Builders. You might want to check out Cruise.io.com.
If you live in the Cruise.io service area, that would be a perfect choice.
You're listening to GeekSpeak. This is Sean Cleveland. In the air room with me are Miles Elam and Drew Meyer. And on the phone is Alex Slias. We can take most all your questions except that last one. But, you know, I think we should do a show just talking about how to start your own website. I think a lot of people want to do it, and it seems easy to do, but when you actually sit down to do it, it is very daunting. And if you can actually take an online template tool and just modify it, that's so much easier. I think I'm going to talk to Lyle about doing a show on this. So, guys, anything else going on? Miles?
Yeah, speaking of fuel, this isn't necessarily hot fuel. This is more synthetic fuel. One thing that people have been working on is fuel generation. We had a show talking about this. Bioengineering crops or bioengineering items for fuel.
Right.
And that's one thing that's being worked on. The Department of Energy is promising $125 million to a team of six national labs and universities to create new, this sounds a little Frankenstein, but create new life forms that are optimized for alcohol production. In other words, for making ethanol.
Genetic modification?
What is it? Genetically modifying it so that you can get a higher yield for alcohol production, which, of course, is putting some people at odds. How do I feel about genetically modified crops? You know, you have that group saying, no, this is absolutely bad. But that same group commonly will say, let's go to an ethanol future as opposed to standard fossil fuels. Now, at the same time, what's interesting about this story is that big struggle there of let's go ethanol. And one of the reasons for it was we need to have and build up an infrastructure for it. And we are building up an infrastructure for ethanol. And it's not particularly corrosive. It's non-toxic, by and large. Of course, if you drink a whole lot of it, it's going to be bad for you. But that's true of alcohol in general.
Right.
And even though there are things like biodiesel, one of the things is one of the obstacles to this is political. One of the main agribusiness lobbies is Archer Daniels Midland. And it's in their interest to grow more corn so that you can have ethanol, even though it doesn't have as high an energy density as some
other
things.
I don't know how I feel about this growing more crops just for fuel when we've got population explosion and we're not growing enough for food.
Right. Well, we are growing enough for food as it is. It's just that to displace that for fuel production means that you don't get to use that area for food. With the amount that we drive, that's where you become. That's where you get the contention. It's not whether you can make the alcohol. It's can you make enough without.
This is so complicated. And Michael Pollan's Omnivore's Dilemma talks about the acreage of the Midwest that's designated to corn production for the use of corn syrup in American food products. And if you look at...
Once again, lobbying Archer Daniels Midland.
Yeah, well, and genetically modified organisms. We did a show on that a couple of weeks back where there's a lot of concern about what happens if this stuff gets out pollination-wise. We don't know what happens when it mixes in the environment. And yeah, there's a benefit, but there may also be a dark side.
Or for that matter, why are we doing this with what's normally a food crop? Why aren't we doing this with something that isn't edible, that people wouldn't
actually
get mixed
eat
up
by
and
mistake,
going, yeah,
you know, or
going
feed
to
their cattle or whatever? Pretty interesting. I wonder if it's worth the risk.
And especially because they are working on alternatives such as algae. There are certain species of algae that by body weight are almost half oil. So what you're doing is making a biodiesel off of that. They're talking about using areas in the Salton Sea, for example, wide open areas that have a high saline content, a lot of sun, that don't compete with traditional farming area or agriculture. Especially not food agriculture.
I think not competing with farming, farmland is actually kind of an important thing. Because if we start displacing that, I mean, we have alternatives. If we can't produce our own food, we end up having to bring it in from externally, from foreign countries. But, with all the recent news you hear about our inability to properly screen, I guess, the stuff we import, that's also another concern, not to mention the cost associated to it.
Well, aside from that, I don't know how quickly we would have to import, but we are a huge food exporter. If we reduce the amount of food, then that means that we eat the lion's share of it, and we don't have that money from the export of food. And other countries miss out on our food exports, which they may be dependent upon.
But then we also have, economically, from our perspective, we can also would have to balance it to the cost of importing fuels.
All right.
More complicated than we can handle
it's
today.
It's really complicated. If you have a question, please give us a call. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. You're listening to Geek Speak. That is a pretty complicated scenario there.
Looks like we got an email question from Perry about any software solutions out there that can send audio from one computer on a LAN to several other computers on the same LAN. Fascinating. So I got a couple of ideas there.
iTunes right off the top of my head.
And we've interviewed a company called Infrant on this radio program in the past with a product that is now owned and manufactured by Netgear. Their product is a network-attached storage device. It's a disk drive in a box, and it includes a built-in iTunes server. So that would be a place to centralize all your music, and then that iTunes server can distribute to any other iTunes machine or multiple machines on the network at the same time. Very simply, one way to do it. That's really more complicated. That's a hardware solution with a software server based in. And if you're looking for just a software piece, iTunes can share information out across the network?
Within iTunes, you can say, you can share all your music, you can just share a playlist, and everywhere else on the network can listen to that song and do so legally.
If they have iTunes, right?
Right.
Yeah, so there's a pretty simple
which is available for Windows and the Mac.
Right. So you can do it cross-platform, you can download it, install it for free, and you can share out any music that you own.
Yeah, and if you're on a PC, you can listen to music from a Mac, and if you're on a Mac, you can listen to it on a Windows box as well. It doesn't have to be the same platform in that. I mean, the software works on multiple platforms, but the sharing works on multiple platforms as well.
So, Perry, send us an email back if that didn't answer the question. I see how you said audio, and you didn't specifically say music, and I wonder if maybe we didn't miss the point of your question, but... We'd be happy to work with you. We got a couple of minutes here, so let us know.
We got a call from Richard in Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
Richard, what do you got for us?
Okay, great. Thanks.
What's your question, Richard?
Oh, hey, hi. You guys do a great job, and when I get a chance to tune in, I always learn something. I have an Apple 17-inch PowerBook, the 133 megahertz from like about 3 years ago, and it's been... like up and down and pretty cool, but recently I think my super drive and my drive died because my disk utility says they're sort of about to die, and then it doesn't play any sound like any of my AVIs or music or even clicks on keys. So I think it might be dead. So I was calling you guys to see if any of that clicked, besides the fact that probably it's time to...
Well, you're talking about two different things there. If the sound's not coming through, then that's the audio processor, the sound card, the equivalent of,
okay.
versus the super drive.
Okay.
If you can't read disks, then yes, that's a problem with the super drive. You can't read any data off of it. But if you're not getting any sound otherwise, that has nothing to do with the super drive. That's another issue with your machine.
Okay.
As for what you can do with it, as a stopgap measure, you can connect up something we were talking about earlier, a USB-based sound card or sound device.
Yeah, that's what kind of – I heard you talking about that, and that's what kind of intrigued me. I was like, hey, maybe that's – yeah, okay.
So that would work. In addition to that, with regard to your super drive, as long as you're willing to issue the use of a super drive within your laptop and don't want to spend the money for another one that's a slot load, you know, fairly expensive, you can get external CD-ROM drives.
And I've been told, like, my processor is on its last legs. I have vertical lines on my screen.
Oh, okay.
So it may just be that your laptop is on its last legs. Yeah. So maybe time to look at a new one.
Yeah, well, I figured I'd call you guys the doctors first, you know, and just let it go. So... all right, so a USB sound card might at least let me listen to movies, and that plugs into the USB thing, and it's sort of like a separate output.
Right, it is a separate output, yeah.
Okay.
From what you're describing, for a laptop, you may want to get one that you connect up to some external speakers as well. They usually don't come with speakers. They're usually just the line-in or the headphone jack. In other words, an 8-inch.
Actually, no problem, because I was using the output, which also doesn't work, and the headphone output jack doesn't work. But I already have a plug-in for speakers. But
you're sure the audio is not muted, right?
Yeah, I checked it muted. I even changed the counts. Like, I kind of went online and looked around, but there was no quick, you know, like, hey. And somebody told me there was an update, and I didn't see it. But I'm pretty updated, you know,
right.
So whatever it was didn't fix it. It was like a super
Sorry we didn't have much better news for you.
Well, no, I just really appreciate it. Let me let you guys go, and thank you again for all your help.
Thank you.
Okay.
I trust that he's tried testing his sound card by sticking headphones into the headphone jack. I guess we didn't suggest
usually
that.
Usually when more than one thing is failing on a computer,
yeah,
it's a good sign that your computer's failing.
Yeah, that lines on the screen thing is pretty nerve-wracking.
So we got a call from Claudia on line 2 from Santa Cruz. Claudia, are you there?
Yes, hi.
Hi. What can we help you with?
I just heard that thing about the vertical lines on the screen. You know, mine showed up with one of that on my desktop. It doesn't go when I have a... connection to the internet or anything, but I don't know. What is that?
Is it a Mac or PC?
PC.
A better question would be, is it a LCD screen or a CRT?
I was going to get to that next, yes.
Well, you've got me. I'm a total naivete.
What kind of computer do you have?
It's a laptop.
It's a laptop.
Okay,
it's a laptop.
So it's an LCD.
Yeah.
Well, it could be the cable between the screen, the little hinging, the lid part between the keyboard and the screen. Sometimes that'll cause that. Sometimes it's a hardware issue with the chips inside, and that's hard to diagnose.
Yeah, lines on the screen I would think is more video processing. So maybe a physical problem.
Do they move, or are they always in the same place?
I was going to say, this thing showed up about the time I was getting hacked, I guess. I've been, worms, hackers, uninvited guests. This was more like a gremlin when it comes up on the screen, and you could click on it and it would do things, and then finally it retreated to just this little quarter of an inch by 1 inch gray space.
Wait, you're saying it's not a line that goes all the way across?
It didn't
from
go
side
all the
side.
Way down. It just now it's retreated to this little hint of a thing there.
Now that's
some
different.
Pop-up came up, like say through Windows Messenger just a hack through IE.
Of some sort.
So I would guess, and I bet you guys agree with me, that this is more likely a software problem. You've got something nasty still on there.
Something nasty in there.
Yeah. So go download Spybot Search and Destroy and run that. And download Lavasoft's AdAware and run that.
Oh, I couldn't really get that. Spybot
Search and Destroy. If you just Google Spybot, you'll find it.
Okay. What has been like that? Spybot and the other one was?
AdAware. AdAware.
Okay, got it. I think I might have some of those on there because I've been having people work on it, and I'm so new at this. I went to Craigslist and somebody gave me a runaround there, and suddenly I was having other visitors using my computer. I mean, there's people taking off my parental controls.
Send us an email and we can recommend some consultants in the area that can help you that we trust.
That would be good.
And
what
also,
I'm facing this morning is that the computer's locked. It won't let me in, and it's asking me, you know, the only way you can get in is this one long code word or administrator and owner, and it's locked. So put in your password. So I put in my password, and it says, nope, that's not it. And it won't let me in, and then it turns itself off.
All right.
And no button will turn
Alex,
it on.
Alex, you're our security guru.
I think there's a couple
guru.
Things. I mean, it sounds like, for one, is your computer connected directly to your DSL modem or your cable modem, or is there a some sort of router in between?
How many boxes between your computer and the wall?
It's how many boxes? Well, there's the modem, and then there's the splitter, so I can talk on the phone and have it.
And then the wall.
Yeah, that's it.
All right. So it sounds like basically your computer is directly exposed to the internet, and somebody has been able to find some vulnerability in Windows and get into your system, and now that they pretty much are controlling it. The first thing I do is unplug it from the wall, just to keep
not the power, in. Not the power, just
not
the cable
the power,
connection,
just the internet connection. For the moment, and go buy some sort of internet router, something that will be another box in between your computer. And
is it called a filter? I found this one box.
No, not the filter. Also, the thing that you plug your computer into, how many ports does it have? Does it have the ability to connect four computers up at once, or is it just your one computer?
You mean you're talking about the modem?
Yeah.
Right.
We're trying to find out if it's really a modem. It might be a router already.
Well, it's this little box. It's DSL. What is it? You know, it's kind of a speed stream.
Okay.
It came with probably the DSL, which I don't really understand that that's any faster than it.
Okay. We're actually reaching the end of the show.
Oh,
and,
sorry.
That's all right.
Best guess, by what's called an internet home gateway.
Yeah, talk to your ISP. They may be able to help you. There's a company called TwoWire that makes a good one. You can look at Linksys or Netgear. They also make good ones.
And then do a quick Google search for Windows password reset.
Well,
help you find some tools to reset.
You know what? Send us an email. Go to geekspeak.org.
No, I can, because the computer's, you know, get down. How about I call you back after the thing and you can tell me just one or two things?
Sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay.
Just hold on the line and we'll come
Yeah,
talk
give us a couple minutes. We'll be back with you.
All right,
okay,
thank you.
I'm just on the block, too, so okay. See you guys. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Next up, House Calls by the Geeks. No, just kidding.
All right, we want to thank you for listening to Geek Speak. To those of you who called in, thanks again for making Geek Speak what it is. We thought you would just be us geeking out, and who wants to listen to that? In the air room today was Miles Elam and Drew Meyer, and on the phone was Alex Sleas. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. I want to, again, invite you to a day of family and fun at Jelly Beans at 2555 SoCal Avenue in Santa Cruz. That's from noon to 4 today. There'll be face painting, a music circle, ice cream social, a clown, much more. Admission is free. Proceeds will benefit the Gomes children who are losing their mother to cancer. Come sing, play, celebrate family at Jelly Beans today out on SoCal Avenue. GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com.